The most important economic event of the past half century was the rise and the fall of double-digit inflation. And it was not just the most important economic event of the past half century, but that it was truly a significant event in our national experience.
Good morning. Following today's forum, Mr. Samuelson will sign copies of his book out front. And so let me ask at the end of the forum if everybody would remain in their place to give Mr. Samuelson the chance to go out and beat the crowd. And we've strategically placed the book-selling station where you cannot leave the building without buying a copy of the book. So it's sort of exciting. This is the first day that the books can be sold by the bookstores, and the official pub date is...
It's a week from tomorrow.
So you will get it in advance of everybody else in the civilized world. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum. Our guest today is Robert J. Samuelson, who is a contributing editor of Newsweek and the Washington Post, where he has written about business and economic issues since 1977. A graduate of Harvard University, Mr. Samuelson began his career with the Post in 1969. And over the years, he's worked there and has been a freelancer whose work has appeared in the Sunday Times, the New Republic, and other important and respected journals. He joined Newsweek in 1984. He has won National Headliner Awards in 1992 and 1993, and won the John Hancock Award for Best Business and Financial Columnist. The author of three books, Samuelson's latest is The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence. Please welcome Robert Samuelson.
Thank you, George. I appreciate it. It's always a pleasure to be back here at the Miller Center. I don't know how many times I've been here, three or four maybe. And I want to thank in absentia Ken Thompson for first coming, inviting me down here. It's sort of become a habit every two or three years. I seem to come down here for one reason or another. And aside from the drive, which I don't like, it's a beautiful drive, but it's about an hour and a half longer than I would prefer. It's always a great experience. For an audience such as this, I want to make the usual disclaimer. It's not a disclaimer I have to make with a younger audience anymore, but I can look out over the sea of faces here and see people who are my contemporaries or even a little bit north of my being my contemporary. And I want to say that I am not related to the famous economist Paul Samuelson. And so that anything I say here that seems inconsistent with what you might have learned in college using Samuelson's text should not be held against the elder Samuelson. He does have a son, I am told, whose name is Robert J. Samuelson. And that deepens the confusion. And he actually preceded me as a columnist for Newsweek. Newsweek in the 1960s pioneered the idea of having economists, of which I am not one, write a journalistic column. And the original column, there were three. There was Milton Friedman, who was considered the conservative, and there was Paul Samuelson, who was considered the liberal, and there was Henry Wallach, who was an economics professor at Yale, who was considered middle of the roader. Wallach dropped out in the early 70s when he was appointed to the Federal Reserve Board, and so for years it continued to be Friedman and Samuelson. In the early 1980s, before I was appointed, Samuelson decided he had had enough of it, and he gave up the column, and Lester Thoreau, a colleague of his at MIT, assumed it. A couple of years later, the Newsweek editors decided that that maybe a journalist who wrote about these issues would be more appropriate than a professional economist, and so they replaced Thoreau and Friedman with me. And Samuelson sent me a very nice letter that, as I remember, the last line of which was, "Somebody named Samuelson can't be all bad." he may have regretted that. I want to talk to you today, and I hope I only talk 30 or 40 minutes so we have time for questions. I don't know how long I'm going to talk, since I haven't timed this talk. But I want to talk to you today and try to persuade you of a proposition that I doubt has occurred to you, and that even if it had occurred to you, I doubt you would believe. And that is that the most important economic event of the past half century was the rise and the fall of double-digit inflation. And it was not just the most important economic event of the past half century, but that it was truly a significant event in our national experience, comparable to the Watergate scandal or even the war in Vietnam and its effect on daily life and its effect on how people felt about themselves and their society, and indeed on the society's progress or lack thereof. Now, these are large claims. And you may think, with good cause, that there are many better candidates for the role that I have anointed double-digit inflation. There is globalization, which is clearly something that people know about and worry about. There is the rise of the internet and personal computing, something that has affected almost all our lives for better or worse. And I just say parenthetically that as someone who grew up in print journalism, this is a technology that has had a devastating effect on my industry, for example. So clearly the internet and personal computers are a huge influence on daily life. And there's the emergence of semi-permanent federal budget deficits. All these are conspicuous contenders for, I would say, the award of the most important economic event of the last 50 years. And yet, the contention I'm going to make is that none of them really measures up to the rise and fall of double-digit inflation for its effects. So these are bold claims. Now let me try to substantiate them and at least get you thinking about it. First, let's go back and review exactly what happened. Now, for an audience like this, not that much is necessary. You lived through it. I lived through it. We probably remember it if we make an effort to do so. That is not true for the majority of Americans. Roughly 60% of Americans now are 45 years or younger. Someone 45 would have been born in 1963, the year I graduated from high school, and in 1980 would have been 17. 1980 and the late 70s and early 80s being the peak of inflation. And I would say an adolescent, even someone in their late teens, probably has only a dim memory of what actually happened during those years. So for most Americans, the rise of double-digit inflation is ancient history. Not for you, not for me. But let me just go over the essentials. Inflation, and by inflation we mean not the rise of one or two prices or selected prices, but the general rise of the price level itself. Most prices rising. So inflation, as measured by the Consumer Price Index, went from 1% in 1960, a basically negligible level, to 13% in 1979 and 1980. What is, I think, really decisive for my argument here is that regardless of its economic effects, and I'm going to assume just for the moment that it had no adverse economic effects, that higher inflation had no adverse effect, economic effects. This is not true, but I'm going to assume it for the moment. Even if inflation had had no bad economic effects, there was one decisive reality about it. People hated it. They just hated higher inflation because it made the future a complete fog. People could not know whether or not their wages and salaries and incomes would keep pace with inflation. They could not know whether or not how much their savings would be eroded by inflation. They could not know how often higher inflation would trigger recessions or how severe these recessions would be. Middle class values, the values of most Americans, hard work, thrift, deferred gratification, planning ahead, all these values were undermined and assaulted by higher inflation. Aside from this, inflation's most profound political effect was to discredit government, because no party or president seemed capable of controlling it, at least at an acceptable social cost. From Lyndon Johnson to Richard Nixon to Jimmy Carter, all presidents wrestled unsuccessfully with inflation. You will notice I left out Gerry Ford. I think had he been reelected, it's possible the story would have been different, but he was really president for too short a time to have had much effect. From Johnson to Nixon to Carter, all of them wrestled unsuccessfully with inflation, adopting, as with Nixon, mandatory wage price controls in 1971, going through 1974, or as with Johnson and Carter, so-called voluntary controls, or standards, or guidelines, incomes policies. There's a variety of euphemisms. But these voluntary policies, which were legally voluntary, involved a good deal of informal government coercion. But nothing seemed to work. Just why high and rising inflation developed is a story I tell at length in the book, and I'm not going to go over it in detail here because this lecture, which hopefully is going to be 40 minutes, would be 2 hours. But the general reason for higher inflation is that the society and the political elites adopted faulty economic doctrines, which at the time were endorsed and promoted by most mainstream economists. In effect, the politicians became enlightened. They took the advice that they were receiving from academics, and which the academics argued to them was good advice. They put it into practice. It turned out it was bad advice, and the attempts to make the prophecies that had been predicted by the academics came true created an increasingly adverse economic and political and social effects. Ultimately, high inflation was ended the old-fashioned way. The Federal Reserve, under then-chairman Paul Volcker in the early 1980s, and supported strongly by the new president, Ronald Reagan, imposed a brutal austerity on America. The Fed squeezed credit, raised interest rates, and put the economy through a horrendous recession, the worst since World War II. And it may turn out that what we're going through now turns out to be worse, but the predictions so far for the current recession don't yet equal the severity of the recession that we went through in the early 1980s. Banks' prime interest rate rose to more than 20%. The unemployment rate peaked in late 1982 at 10.8%. There were gluts of everything, steel, cars, office space, and obviously workers. Companies could no longer simply increase prices and pass along higher costs, because if they did, they would either lose profits, suffer losses, or in extreme cases, actually go bankrupt. So companies curtailed wage increases, and the effect of that was reinforced by the widespread use of COLA clauses, cost of living clauses, that tied wages to prices, so that as price increases receded, so did wage increases. In this period from 1982, really 1980 in some ways, through 1982, the economy did not advance at all. The worst inflationary psychology in the society was wrung out. By 1983, inflation was down to 4%, and this rampant and widespread inflationary psychology really has never returned since then. All right, those are the bare facts of what happened. All right, now let's just look at what were the consequences of rising inflation, aside from those I've already talked about. The first, and I think is now widely overlooked, although it wasn't overlooked in 1980, the first was the election of Ronald Reagan as president and the elevation of the conservative movement really into the mainstream of American politics. Until Reagan's election, many of the ideas with which he was associated were essentially considered either fringe or far-right ideas. And Reagan gave them respectability. Reagan, however, did not win the election, in my view, on the basis of his conservative ideology. In American politics, there really is a very simple dynamic that goes on often, not always, but often. And that is, if people don't like what's going on in the country, they vote against the guy who is in, and they vote for the guy who represents the party who is out. And that is essentially what happened in 1980. Americans were desperate about inflation. All the polls showed that inflation was the issue that weighed most heavily on people's minds. It overshadowed the Iranian hostage crisis, which I think people now remember more vividly than inflation. Inflation was the decisive issue, in my view, in the 1980 election, and that is what Carter said after the election. He said he lost the election because of inflation. And in my view, if inflation had been 3% instead of 13%, Ronald Reagan would have lost, he would have gone back to California and retired, and Jimmy Carter would have had a second term, even with the Iranian hostage crisis. Reagan was seen basically as an outsider. He was seen as a potential radical. Carter, however, was viewed as incompetent. And between Carter's known incompetence and Reagan's possible radicalism, Americans essentially were willing to gamble. The great paradox of the Reagan presidency, in my view, is that Reagan, who portrayed himself and no doubt actually felt that he was an anti-government candidate, the candidate of small government, actually restored popular faith in government, because he showed that it could control what people had come to believe it could not control, inflation. And that was a momentous achievement that has largely been overlooked in the Reagan biographies and the Reagan appraisals and the so-called historical appraisals of the age of Reagan. If you look, for example, at Reagan's obituaries and the postmortems of his legacy that ran after his death, you will find little or no mention of inflation at all. People just concentrate on his tax cuts, they concentrate on his rhetoric, and they concentrate, I think, properly on the approaching end of the Cold War and his relations with Gorbachev. But the defeat of double-digit inflation, in my view, was his most significant domestic achievement, both because it reinvigorated the economy and because it restored faith in government and in the nation's leaders, something which had really dissipated in the late 1970s. Let me now just review for you what the economic consequences of high inflation were. The first and the most obvious was that it simply destabilized the economy. Between 1969 and 1981, there were four recessions of growing severity. Those of 1969-70, those of 1973-75, 1980, and 1981-82. As inflation rose, from time to time, the Federal Reserve would attempt to push it back, and they would raise interest rates and put the economy into a recession, but they wouldn't do it long enough to actually have a permanent effect. So you had these stop-go policies in which we would have an expansion, inflation would increase, the Federal Reserve would get upset, they'd raise interest rates, the economy would go into a recession, they'd get upset that the economy was in a recession, they'd ease policy, and we'd have even higher inflation as we came out of the recession. So you had this ongoing destabilization of the economy, and as I said earlier, people did not know where it would stop or if it would ever stop. It just seemed to things seemed to be spiraling more and more out of control. The second effect was, and a parallel effect was, high inflation crushed the stock market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, on average, in 1982, was no higher than it was in 1965. It was under 900, the average for the year in both years. If you adjusted that for the inflation that had occurred in this period, there was a huge loss in the real value of stocks over this period. And essentially what you had is that people not being able to see the future and watching interest rates go up and inflation go up basically moved money from stocks into money market funds and bank deposits and bonds that had higher interest rates and at least would offered the prospect of protecting their capital against rising inflation. And finally, on the economic front, productivity, that's the fancy term for what most people regard as efficiency. Productivity, which is the wellspring of higher living standards for this country and any other country, essentially stagnated in the late 1970s. The more inflation went up, the more productivity growth went down. And so inflation, in my view at least, was a proximate cause for the stagnation of incomes that occurred in the late 1980s. And the process by which this happened, I think, there are a number of channels through which this might have operated. In my view, the most obvious was probably the most important. And that is, as inflation went up and prices went up, managers were distracted from improving the underlying operations of their companies and focus more on when and by how much should they increase prices, because that became a much more significant determinant of their near-term profitability than almost any productivity improvements they might make in their operations. So that's the story of higher inflation. And it is a story that if you actually search the historical record, you can find everything that I've talked about is there somewhere. It seems to me that people haven't really put it together in the way they should have, but this is a story that if not fully appreciated, at least is recorded. There is another part of the story, however, which I think is not really recorded at all or very much, and that is the consequences of inflation's fall. Essentially, we went from double-digit inflation at the end of the 70s and early 80s to 4% in the mid-80s, and we progressively, with some upticks during the intervening periods, reduced it to about 1% at the turn of the century. So you have basically here a 40-year period when inflation goes from 1% to 13% between 1960 and 1979 and 80, and it goes from those levels basically back to 1% in 2000 and 2001. That decline in inflation over the last 25 years or so has had profound effects on American society and the American economy. And here, too, we find a paradox. For most of this period, this disinflation, falling inflation, this disinflation was a boon to the economy. The economy performed well, even though everybody repeatedly and chronically complained about it. There were only two brief recessions during this period, each lasting 8 months, 1990-91 and 2001. The highest unemployment rate during the entire period was 7.8% after the 1990-91 recession. The stock market exploded, as almost everybody knows. Remember, in 1982, the Dow Jones was less than 1,000. By 1999, the Dow had passed 10,000. The pervasiveness, and here's the paradox, the pervasiveness of this prosperity actually caused bad habits. It bred bad habits, and we are seeing now the consequences of these bad habits in the present financial crisis. In my view, this present financial crisis is the last great effect of disinflation, because the prosperity that we had for most of the period since 1980s encouraged people to believe that stock prices and housing prices would only go up, and basically created a climate in which speculative practices and complacent and careless financial practices took root. Let me just step back from that a second. I'm going to come back to that. But let me just go over quickly the consequences of disinflation and why they generally explain what happened to the economy over these past two decades. The most obvious consequence was a consumer spending boom. As inflation subsided, interest rates came down because interest rates reflect inflation. People want to be protected, have their money protected, so they will lend out only at rates that seem to cover the rate of inflation and provide them some real return. So as inflation declined, interest rates declined, people began shifting their money back into stocks And we got this stock market explosion that I talked about earlier. As stocks went up, people felt wealthier. Same thing happened as housing prices went up. People then began to borrow against their increased housing and stock market wealth. They began to spend more of their income. The personal savings rate, which had been 10, 11% in the early 1980s, gradually declined. And so by 2005, the personal savings rate was essentially zero. And you got a huge explosion in consumer spending on cars, on meals out, on vacations, college tuition, personal computers, cell phones, internet service. All this spending was the fundamental pillar of the prosperity we've had over the last several decades. To some extent, that added demand was satisfied by imports. And that is the second great consequence of disinflation, a consequence hardly, it seems to me, recognized or appreciated. And that is disinflation promoted globalization. And by globalization, I mean the expansion of international trade and finance. Disinflation promoted globalization in two ways. First, as inflation declined, the dollar, which was the, since World War II, the principal international currency, the dollar's value increased dramatically on foreign exchange rates, exchange markets. It had depreciated in the late 1970s. It increased in the early 1980s. It rose between 1980 and 1985, it rose 62% against the Deutschmark, 112% against the French franc, 5% against the Japanese yen. What this meant is that imports into the United States became cheaper, our exports became more expensive, or put another way, the dollar's rise favored other countries' exports. And because most countries see exports as a good thing because they create jobs, this made it easier for them to embrace globalization. It made it easier for them to liberalize trade barriers because liberalization meant more exports, and exporting was in their interests. In effect, globalization was subsidized by the high dollar, which in turn was a consequence of disinflation. People could trust the value of a dollar, so they were willing to hold dollars and, in fact, sought out dollar and dollar investments. The stronger dollar likewise encouraged the cross-border flow of money. Now, if you go back, this is somewhat technical, but it's extremely important. If you go back to the late 70s and early 1980s, the world was characterized by capital controls. That is to say, most governments, not ours, and there were a few others that didn't, but most governments had laws that said foreigners could not invest in our country, or they could invest in our country only in the following ways, if they get the following approvals from following government agencies or bureaucracies. And our nationals cannot invest abroad except under these restricted conditions, for which they would also have to get permission from, usually get permission from their governments. So essentially you had a world in which there was people invested and saved inside their own borders. That world has broken down and no longer exists. And the main reason it broke down, in my view, or at least a main reason that it broke down, was the renewed faith in the dollar and the willingness to use the dollar as an international currency. There was a dynamic that occurred here that, again, I think is not widely appreciated. As America began running trade deficits, all those dollars went abroad. People, the countries that earned those dollars, had to do something with them. So they began investing in the United States. We had very few capital controls. So as they began investing in the United States, the case for maintaining their remaining and existing capital controls began to diminish. And people around the world wanted more freedom to invest across borders because they were experiencing this really for the first time since World War II. And so you got a very gradual but persistent dismantling of these capital controls. Again, extremely technical. One country would do various things, but it became a kind of conventional wisdom that dismantling capital controls would be good for their societies, and so they did it. And so we basically have a different kind of financial system that today than we had 25 or 30 years ago. It is a globalized system where essentially before we had a series of national systems. Finally, by restoring U.S. economic stability, disinflation enhanced the prestige and power of the American economic model in the late 1980s and in the early 1990s when the Cold War ended and essentially communism collapsed and disappeared. If you can imagine for a moment what would have happened after, if communism has collapsed, and it's not clear to me that if the United States had remained in the kind of economic crisis that we were in the late 70s, that communism would have collapsed. We would have been too preoccupied with our own internal problems to present the kind of technological and economic threat to the Soviet Union that we did during the 1980s. But even assuming that communism had collapsed in the late 80s and early 90s, if the United States had been in the kind of perpetual running crisis that we were in the 1970s, we would not have really been the model for the rest of the world to adopt. And it's unclear, again, what would have happened, but it seems quite plausible to me that the widespread adoption of free market or market-oriented economic policies and the more sympathy towards the capitalist model would not have occurred but for the favorable climate that disinflation created in the United States and the way people read this around the world. Now let me get to the bad news, which is the present financial crisis. And again, I think you can find the roots of this in the consequences of disinflation. And I think it basically is a tragic demonstration of the old adage that too much of a good thing can be bad. The conventional analyses of the current financial crisis blame a number of villains: lax and sometimes fraudulent lending standards by mortgage bankers, greed by investment bankers who package these mortgage loans into complex and opaque securities, incompetence by the rating agencies who gave these securities unjustifiably high ratings, excessively low interest rates by the Federal Reserve, inadequate regulatory supervision by federal agencies, a general political climate that promoted home ownership and thereby encouraged and condoned all these self-defeating practices that led, with hindsight, to poor mortgages being made, large losses is occurring among banks, investment banks, and other financial institutions, and a widespread loss of confidence in the entire worldwide financial system. Now, up to a point, I would say all these causes are legitimate, and we will debate for years how we ought to apportion blame among them. But they all overlook, in my view, the large contributing role played by disinflation, which had two effects. The first was, as I mentioned before, that the consistent downward trend in interest rates over the period from the early 80s to the late 90s and into the new century, and you will remember that in the early 80s, government bonds were 13-14%, mortgages were in the same area. As I said, the bank prime lending rate was 20%. And you know where these rates are today. So the consistent downward trend in interest rates and the parallel upward march in asset prices, in stock prices and then home prices, convinced people, falsely, that prices could only go in one direction. They would go up forever because they had gone up for the last 15 or 20 years. There would be fluctuations and interruptions, but the basic trend line was up. Once this mindset took hold, it condoned increasingly reckless and speculative investment and lending practices because people lost their sense of risk. And by people, I mean the most sophisticated investment bankers and ordinary consumers and homeowners who borrowed. People just lost their sense of risk. And so you got rank speculation, based purely on the idea that what happened yesterday would happen tomorrow. The first evidence of this was the great tech bubble of the late 1990s, when stock prices went to what was apparent to some of us, completely silly and absurd levels that could not be sustained. And yet people continued buying these stocks until ultimately the bubble burst. Unlike the housing crisis, there was plenty of warnings in the late 1990s from reputable investors and investment advisors. Even at some of the major brokerage houses, the chief investment strategists were saying, because they were older and they had lived through cycles, this cycle is not going to go on. This is not a new era. Prices will go down because they are too high. Many of those people were eased out of their jobs because they were basically putting out a message of prudence and caution when their higher ups in these investment banks and brokerage houses wanted everybody to believe that, in fact, prices would go up forever and at accelerating rates. Warren Buffett warned. I warned. Nobody listened to me. The housing crisis was different. People really didn't warn about the housing crisis in the same way that they did about the stock bubble. But my point in going back to the stock bubble is that when markets are going up, people don't care that somebody says they won't continue going up. Everybody wants to be on the train, and if you're not on the train, you're regarded as a moron. And I can tell you this from personal experience, because I write these columns. And in fact, the bubble didn't burst as quickly as I thought it would, and people would look at me like, you know, pretty, this, he's probably the only guy in America who hasn't made a lot of money here. But the more, they just looked at me like, you know, I'd become untethered from reality. And the point I'm making here is that you can't really stop one of these things very easily once it gets going, because it becomes, there is a kind of herd psychology that takes place both on the upside and the downside of markets. So that was the first consequence of this extended prosperity, the extended decline in interest rates, and the parallel rise in asset prices. But the second consequence was that inflation essentially destroyed the old financial system. The old financial system, as existed before 1980, was essentially a system that was based on depository institutions, commercial banks, and savings and loan institutions. It was a very simple model. You deposit your money, mainly savings, with a bank or an S&L at some interest rate, say 3 or 4%. And the bank or the S&L would lend it out at a somewhat higher interest rate, 4 or 5 or 6% for a mortgage, and a higher rate for a construction loan or a business loan or whatever. And the bank or the S&L made its profit, covered its expenses on the spread between what it was borrowing from you and what it was lending to somebody else. That system was devastated by higher inflation, because as interest rates rose on short-term interest rates rose, basically the cost of money to banks and S&Ls rose. We got the creation of money market funds so people could take their money out of banks and put them in money market funds, or they could buy treasury securities, T-bills, or whatever. The cost of money rose for banks and S&Ls, but the rate of return on their older mortgages and their older loans, which had been made at lower interest rates, didn't rise. These had all been made at fixed rates, and so they were put in a squeeze. The S&L industry was essentially wiped out. Banks weren't wiped out, but they went through a period of real stringency. And what you got, given their weakness, is you got a parallel system of investing that came into being, including securitized loans, most prominently securitized mortgages, or these mortgages were packaged into these securities and then sold to investors like pension funds or insurance companies or college endowments. And you got a variety of other investment forums that were using a lot of borrowed money to make investment bets of one sort or another. The combination of this mindset, where people thought that prices would only go up, and this new financial system which is based on large amounts of borrowed money and leverage, has turned out to be toxic. It is unstable, and that, in my view, is the fundamental origin of the present financial crisis and why it is so difficult to understand and so difficult to anticipate where it is going, and I think, frankly, so scary. But it is, to come back to my original theme, a delayed consequence of disinflation. So let me come back to that original argument and just summarize it for you quickly. My argument is that the rise and fall of double-digit inflation represented the most consequential economic event of the past half century and a major occurrence in our general history. On the way up, it destabilized the economy, caused more frequent and harsher recessions, raised the general level of unemployment, led to the election of Ronald Reagan, discredited government, and generally undermined people's faith in the future and in their leaders. On its way down, disinflation promoted two decades of general prosperity, higher living standards, the spread of globalization, a resurgent stock market, a new financial system, and now, sadly, this worldwide financial crisis. Separately, many of these consequences, I believe, are enormously significant. Together, they represent, in my view, a powerful influence that shaped our national life over the past half century. Now, I may not have convinced you, but I hope I at least have given you some grounds for reflection and thought. That's it. I'm happy to answer questions about
I will move to the back of the room and invite those who have questions and would like to participate in the discussion to meet me in the back corner, and we will take as many questions as we have time to do.
And let me just add that I'm happy to take questions on the current economy, what I've talked about, the Obama administration. My answers will be no better than your answers, but I'm happy to take the questions anyway.
Mr. Samuelson, let me start the conversation by asking about the situation confronting the new president. This election is probably very much in line with the Reagan-Carter election of 1980, where people were dissatisfied with what was going on and voted in someone about whom they didn't know a great deal but were willing to take the risk. But now the public expects President Obama to be able to do something to fix the problems. What are the most immediate things that this new president should do? And does he have the tools in the toolbox that he needs to do them? Or is he going to have to invent some new tools?
You know, I suppose if I really had a great answer to that, he would have me in and appoint me to his team. I don't want to be appointed to anybody's team, but I mean, you know, that's a $64 question. I think he should do two. First, let me explain. I'm basically a free market guy. I mean, I believe that free markets are good. I believe that it's one reason that the American economy has been successful over the years. I think it's also part of our political culture, that it's part of our freedom. And so I don't consider that to make me a right-wing extremist, but I just think that this is part of our national heritage and that the record is pretty good. Having said that, I think that this is one of the I don't think free markets, however, are utopia. I think that markets tend to go to extremes and they tend to go to excess, and sometimes you can just let those excesses play out. You have to let them play out sometimes. If you try to intervene all the time, you don't have free markets anymore. I mean, you've got to have winning and losing in markets. Otherwise, as I think I pointed out in the talk, you get self-defeating behavior. If people think there's no downside risk, they will take lots of upside risks, and you will make the system paradoxically more unstable by intervening too often. So I hope I've established my credentials. Having said that, I think this is one of the times where we need intervention. And I do think we need a second stimulus package. The danger here is that because we really don't understand this crisis very well, and because it is worldwide in nature, and because it involves a financial system that is poorly understood even by the people who are in it, never mind by the people who are supposed to be regulating it, that there is a danger that we do get a downward spiral. In most cases, I think markets are self-stabilizing. But there are times when you can get a downward spiral. That when, and in the simplest form, the downward spiral that's conceivable now would be there are losses on loans, financial institutions cut back on lending and investing because they want to hoard cash and they're afraid of dealing with other people, other institutions. The cutbacks in credit contract the economy more. As the economy contracts more, there are more losses, and you get the process just feeding on itself. And the government is incapable of intervening to stop it. Now, we have had a lot of intervention in the last 3 months to stop this. The Federal Reserve is pumping, has in effect substituted itself for all the lenders who don't want to lend, and has provided enormous amounts. I think the amount now is $2 trillion in terms of short-term credit to sort of break this cycle. And other central banks, meaning government banks, are doing the same thing to a greater or lesser degree. But there is a limit to which the financial system by itself will right the economy, I think. I think we do need another stimulus package. I think it should be larger rather than smaller. I think in an ideal world it will be crafted in such a way that we do not create permanent increases in spending or permanent reduction in taxes, which will worsen our long-term budget outlook. And I think that's one of the things Obama should try to do. But whether he'll do it, I don't know. But we do need a second stimulus package. And I will say something now that 2 months ago, well, maybe not 2 months ago, but certainly 2 years ago, I would not have said. And that is, I think we need to rescue the auto industry. To let this major part of the manufacturing base of this country go into bankruptcy with all the uncertainties that that involves, it seems to me would be flirting with disaster. Now, I, as a young reporter, covered the bailout of Chrysler, and I can't tell you how much it upset me. The Carter people who did this basically said they weren't bailing out Chrysler, they were doing something else. And I can remember having a session with the Treasury, and I was younger then, obviously, being in an interview with the Treasury Secretary, G. William Miller, and I just kind of lost it. I mean, I foamed at the mouth. You know, you can't do this kind of thing. They did it. But I think we're in different circumstances now. And I don't think this is a risk we want to take. I do think that if the government rescues GM and Chrysler and Ford, they need to exact very stiff terms. I would say the terms ought to be 20% cut in wages right away. The government gets warrants for 25% of these companies so that any increase in stock price between the time that the bailout is made and the time that the government can get its money paid back, the government can exercise its warrants. It would not maintain an ownership in these companies, but it would have the right to profit from the rescue. And there ought to be some relief to these companies from the union on their legacy costs. So this should be unpleasant for the people involved. But I think we have to put the national interest above ideology here. And the other thing that we need to do this is a long answer to a short question. The other thing we absolutely need to do is we need to get off this roller coaster of energy policy, whereas we, during periods of high prices, people go berserk and say, oh my God, we need to have fuel-efficient cars, and then prices go down, and people just forget about it. We need to create some insulation and some long-term signal that says to consumers, energy costs, at least for gasoline, are going to be higher. And when you buy your vehicles, you need to take that into account. We need to introduce either a tax or a tariff or something to make that signal. We've already told the manufacturers that they have to meet much higher fuel efficiency standards by 2020 from roughly 25 miles a gallon to 35 miles a gallon. We need to create a market that demands those kind of vehicles, as opposed to simply having the government say, well, we like really cheap energy, and we are going to require people to buy more expensive cars that are smaller and get better fuel efficiency, even if fuel is cheap. We need to reconcile this contradiction, because it really has, in my view, created enormous problems for the industry over the last 20 years or so. That's the short answer to the long question.
Yes, I have a question about the recession of 81, 82. I was working at a major Wall Street bank at the time, and I had the very distinct impression throughout that the Reagan administration opposed what was going on, that it was entirely the work of Paul Volcker and the Fed. And I heard you say otherwise this morning, and that rather surprised me from my own recollections of what was going on.
Can I recommend that you buy the book? Here is the answer. I think you're about 80% right in the perception of things, and I think you're about 20% right in the reality. The reality was that the administration favored a tighter monetary policy to bring down inflation, and this was in their documents. The other reality was that on technical grounds, there was constant criticism of the Fed from various parts of the administration, often inconsistent. Sometimes the money supply was growing too fast, sometimes it was growing too slowly, the Fed couldn't get it right, Volcker was inept, blah, blah, blah. There was an enormous amount of criticism of what Volcker was doing from Congress. It was completely bipartisan. After a while, there was one person in the country who didn't support that, and that was Reagan. And he was on the record as not supporting it. He said so in private meetings. He supported Volcker. He didn't do this conspicuously in the sense that he did it every 4 or 5 days. I mean, what president would get up and say, you know, things are bad. We have 8.5% unemployment. It's probably going to go higher. But we're just going to have to suck it up and live through it. I mean, this is not the kind of thing a president likes to do. I quote in the book something. But there were a number of places where he was asked. He did support Volcker. He did so in private meetings. It's all on the record if you piece it together. And the idea that Reagan was somehow ignorant of what was going on is just silly. I remember this at the time. It was a little AP item. I think it was December of 1982. It was late 82, and he was giving his weekly radio address. I think, and that was an institution that he actually created, I think, the weekly presidential radio address. And he was testing the mic before he began to give the address, and the mic was open to the press room. He didn't know that. And he said something like, it's in the book, I forgot, but he said something like, my fellow Americans, we're in a hell of a mess. Reagan did not make much of this in his memoirs. Nobody has made much of this. And so far, it's hard to know exactly what was going on in his head. Bob Novak, the columnist, has his office, as you probably know, has cancer and he's not been into work for a long time. But Bob Novak's office is actually on the same floor in the same building as the Newsweek Bureau, and I know Bob slightly, and I interviewed him for this book. And he said that Reagan had a view going back to the 70s that high inflation, first place, Reagan believed, unlike every other president before him, he believed Milton Friedman. Too much money was the cause of high inflation. You could not regulate it through wage and price controls. And that's on the record. Again, it's in the book. But Reagan had the view, according to Novak, who had interviewed him many times, going back, I guess, probably into the 60s, but certainly in the 70s. And it was expressed in the mid-70s. He said, this country's going to have to go through a period of what he called bellyache, to get rid of the inflation. His advisors apparently convinced him to drop that term. But the best explanation I've been able to get is that he just believed this had to be done. And I call this chapter, this alliance between Volcker and Reagan, which was an informal alliance, I call it a compact of conviction. They both believed society could not flourish under these conditions of high inflation. And there was a kind of division of labor here. Volcker did the dirty work. He got in there with his credit sledgehammer and he just took it to the economy and he just clobbered it. But he could not have succeeded unless it had time to work its way out. And every time the Fed had raised interest rates since the late 60s, it had not done it long enough and persistently enough to create an expectation that it was not going to let inflation get out of hand. That's what Reagan did. And I think it is a tremendous accomplishment that almost nobody pays any attention to.
First of all, I agree with you on the importance of the double-digit inflation. I remember those "with inflation now" buttons. And I also agree that the delayed reaction to the disinflation caused all these bursting bubbles. Just last Friday, I heard an economist say during a lecture that he expects Mr. Bernanke to use to let inflation go up as part of his solution to the present crisis. My question is, first of all, do you agree with that? And second, if that is the case, how safe are we? How many tools do we have to keep that under control so that it won't end up going out of control and going up to double digits again?
Well, I don't know. We're in a really perilous time, it seems to me. I mean, there is a danger. The Fed has put out an enormous amount of short-term credit, as I talked about earlier. And I think in technical terms, you can rationalize that by saying there is there was a huge leap in demand for liquidity, for dollars, for short-term credit or whatever, and the Fed has accommodated that. It's not being spent, it's not being lent to a large extent, and as long as it's simply accommodating this shift in the demand, it won't be inflationary. But the Fed faces a potential paradox. That is to say, if it succeeds in restoring confidence and restoring normal lending, there's now all this short-term money out there, and if they don't somehow draw it back in, there is the potential for an inflationary explosion. I don't know what will happen. There's another danger, however. I actually have a column in the Washington Post this morning about this, and that is if the real economy gets worse, much worse, there's a possibility of deflation. That is to say, not just decline in inflation, but actual declines in prices. Now, I think a modest decline in prices of 1 or 2%, the world is not going to end. I have the same view of a modest deflation as I have of a modest inflation of 1 or 2%. People really won't notice it very much. You get beyond a couple of percent, however, and it would be a territory we have never been in since the Great Depression. And there are two mechanisms by which a large deflation could create this vicious circle, this self-reinforcing vicious circle of downward economic activity. One is, if people think prices are going to be lower tomorrow than they are today, they're going to postpone buying things. Now, obviously, they're not going to postpone buying food, but they may postpone buying appliances, they may postpone buying cars or whatever, and so that feeds on itself. And the second thing is that it makes it harder to repay debts, because the debts were contracted in dollars, and the businesses are now earning dollars that are more expensive. And so it becomes harder to pay off the past debts, and you have the problem that would feed into the financial system and create more losses and financial failures. If we come out of this with just a normal recession, by which I mean even unemployment going to 9%, even 10%, but coming down, if we come out of this with a normal recession, I think the reviews of Bernanke's stewardship are going to be very favorable, and because he's done an enormous amount of innovation here. If things get much worse, his reputation will be awful.
I'm sorry, but the prior speaker asked the question I was going to ask of you, and that was our concern about hyperinflation, but I think you touched on that. So I had a second question, though, concerning the rumored so-called AMRO, okay?
I'm sorry, the
AMRO, by virtue of your traveling around the economic cycles, you know, with your peers and so forth, have you heard the speculation about the combination of the Mexican, the U.S., and the Canadian currency into one combined currency called the AMRO? This has been floated around. I don't know if there's any substance to this
I've heard it. I've never had anybody in any kind of position of anything talk to me about it. I have to say, in our current circumstance, first of all, I don't think the Mexicans will do it. Second, I don't think the Canadians would do it. And third, I don't think the Americans would do it. Aside from that, I'm not sure it's a good or a bad idea. It might be a good idea, I don't know. But I think politically, I am one of these people who believes that a currency is not just money. It's an expression of national sovereignty. It's an expression of who a people are. And to give up your currency, to give up your identity in that way, is a huge political statement. And that's, to some extent, that's what the Europeans were attempting to do when they adopted the euro. The euro has some economic rationale, but the main rationale for it was political. It was, we are going to be a united entity here. And we are defined not just by common regulatory institutions and some common political institutions, but we're so certain of this new evolving identity, we're going to create a money for it. Well, the Brits did not opt into that. I say, long live the pound. And there are now strains in the system because trying to create this one currency for an area that truly isn't yet a unified economy in the sense that the United States is, or is not a unified political entity in the sense the United States is, it was a daring leap. I didn't support it at the time. I hope it works. But so I don't think we're going to give up our currency. If the Mexicans voluntarily adopted the dollar, we might not object. But
thanks, Mr. Samuelson, for being here this morning. Really enjoyed your comments. Just wondered if you'd take a minute or two to say if you think the movement away from the gold standard or any kind of a fixed standard onto fiat currency had any influence in what happened the last couple of decades, or is there a role going forward to move back to a fixed, maybe a basket of commodities or a gold standard?
Well, let me see. The thought that occurs to me is buy this book. Because I do discuss this in the book. I think that for those of you who aren't that conversant with our economic history, the United States essentially operated on a gold standard from the inception to the Great Depression. Now, there were times where we were on a gold and silver standard. There were times when we had paper money, that mainly during the Civil War, that wasn't backed by a gold. But we were essentially on a metallic standard for most of this period. And the basic logic of a metallic standard, whether it be gold or silver or anything else, is that the government is handcuffed in how much money it can create. Because the money it creates, either the money is purely the metal, you only have gold coins or whatever, or if you do have paper money, it's backed by gold. So you can take a $20 bill and go into a bank or go into an office of the Treasury and get $20 worth of gold coins. So people have a sense that it has value and that the value cannot easily be manipulated by the government. I think we are, in theory, better off without a gold standard. Gold standard subjected the economy to a great deal of instability because, to some extent, the money supply depended on the availability or the unavailability of gold. However, the gold standard did have virtues, and one of its virtues is that it automatically put a limit on inflation. Even when there was more gold, the inflation was fairly mild. Once you abandon this system, It meant that under a system of fiat currency, meaning the government essentially prints the money, the people who were regulating the money supply, namely the Federal Reserve, had to assume responsibility for controlling inflation. The argument I make in the book is that after World War II, the people in charge didn't fully understand, I think at an intellectual level they understood it, but they didn't fully grasp what their responsibilities under this new regime. And the dangers of inflation were minimized for a variety of technical reasons, and off to the races we went.
Bob Samuelson, you don't always bring us good news, but you do, you do put the news in context and help us to see it and understand it more clearly. Thank you very much.